Making changes to the mask rules in school and the widening wage gap between genders. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This week, school districts have made masks optional for all students. Falling infection rates, rising vaccination rates, and lowering the age of eligibility to get vaccines all lead South Florida schools to remove mask mandates. Two local school leaders will join us for the latest. And then, the pandemic has really hurt working women with lost jobs and many women not returning to the job market. Even before COVID-19, though, the pay gap between men and women was getting wider here. Why? How can that gap be filled? And why is it important for all households? It's all ahead with your phone calls on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. South Florida public school children can now opt out of wearing a face mask in their classrooms. This week, Broward and Miami-Dade County public school districts revised their mask policies. After months of enforcing a mask mandate, masks are now strongly encouraged in Broward schools, for instance. Parents in Miami-Dade County can fill out a form to have their children opt out of using face masks. And after a judge's ruling last week, parents in Palm Beach County Public Schools have the opportunity to opt out of having their child wear a face mask in school as well. Palm Beach County parent Jenneth DeFederico has three boys, 10, 14, and 16 years old. She says despite the updated mask rules in Palm Beach County Public Schools, her children will continue wearing masks.
My older two, the 14 and 16, wear the mask everywhere. My 10-year-old, since he's played sports and everything, he kind of takes his mask off from time to time. But for the most part, if we're in like large crowds or going places that do have a lot of people, then he wears his mask.
School leaders pointed to decreasing COVID hospitalizations and decreasing COVID infections and the availability of vaccines now for children ages 5 years old and older. So we want to hear from you across South Florida. Are you ready to send your child to school without a mask mandate in place? Maybe you're already have opted out of that school mask requirement. Do you think it's safe? What precautions are you continuing to follow? Do you think the updated mask rules are overdue? Teachers and school employees, how about your comfort level with the updated mask rules for students? 800-743-WLRN as we're live across the region here on this Friday afternoon at 800-743-9576. Parents and teachers, we'd love to hear from you. If you are going to school, we'd love to hear from you as well. Maybe you're on a lunch break here on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-9576. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are at WLRN. Dr. Vicki Cartwright is with us, the Broward County Public Schools interim superintendent. Dr. Cartwright, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you again.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and looking for this opportunity.
We've got a lot to talk about, and Dr. Steve Gallen is also with us, Vice Chair and District 1 School Board Member for the Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Dr. Gallen, welcome back to WLRN as well.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to speak with you about this critical issue and look forward to the discussion.
Absolutely. Let me start with the superintendent, Dr. Cartwright. How many opt-out requests has Broward County received, or is it too early to tell?
So at this point in time, we're taking a slightly different approach than what Miami-Dade County is doing. Rather than having an opt-out process, we're making it to where they don't have to complete a form ahead of time. So if a parent or a student chooses not to wear a face covering, then they'll be allowed to be able to do that. But of course, we continue with our messaging of strongly encouraging people to wear the face covering.
So just to be clear, there's no paperwork involved. The student can simply walk into a Broward County Public School without a face mask on.
That is correct.
Dr. Gallen, that differs obviously in Miami-Dade County, where there is some paperwork involved. Do you support the decision that was made, first of all, to drop the mask requirement?
Absolutely. As the board member that initially sponsored the item for the facial coverings, the item was initially predicated on the critical use of science and data. We stayed true to that particular focus. We've never compromised or wavered on our decision relative to the importance and utilization of data. And presently, the data has driven us to this particular decision to lift the mask mandate. So it was not based on politics, but it was based on science and data. And I think we're better for it.
Important distinction there, Dr. Gallen, apologies for the interruption. Important distinction there, of course, is because Miami-Dade and Broward did, you know, face the ire of the State Department of Education for having those mask mandates in place. And in fact, Broward and Miami-Dade were parties to a lawsuit. That distinction that you make, Dr. Gallen, is certainly with that context, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it really speaks to the integrity of the decision that we made. So it was not a decision that wavered from the initial focus that we made. We made a decision predicated on science and data, and we pivoted from that initial decision based on science and data. So we maintained the integrity of our decision-making process, which was focused on utilizing science and data for the safety of our children and our employees.
Dr. Cartwright, how about the backing of the decision in Broward County? What influence, if any, did the State Board of Education and its... Well, I suppose the friction that this has been creating between Broward County Public Schools and the state, as well as the legal action.
So, you know, our board has been saying this the entire time is based upon the local data of our county, and that they were going to use the information for here, what we are experiencing within our district. So it had nothing to do with any of the threats or the conversation or even the upcoming conversation that's going to be occurring next week. It's just we finally hit that threshold where our board was comfortable in making that decision to proceed forward and being able to say, okay, given that the data, the positivity rate is so low at this point in time, even the number of quarantining in our district is so low for the size of the district. And then also taking a look at the vaccines now being available, we're very fortunate in our partnership with the Broward County Health Department here, because we are actively going to be going out. And for parents who give permission, so it's not required, but parents who give permission for their child to be vaccinated will be able to do that. And prior to the Thanksgiving break, we'll have gone out to 70% of our elementary schools, at least for the first round of the vaccinations.
Dr. Cartwright is with us, the superintendent, interim superintendent of Broward County Public Schools. Dr. Steve Gallen also with us, a vice chair of the Miami-Dade County Public School Board. Your phone calls at 800-743-9576. Both districts easing back on those mask mandates in place for students this week. Chris is listening and calling in from Cooper City. Chris, thanks for calling. Great to hear from you. Thanks for your time.
Hey, how are you? Good. I'm just calling in here to express my support for, you know, removing the mask mandate. We've had quite a low case of COVID at this point in time, and I also feel very comfortable sending my kids, and they're in elementary school right now, and I don't see any harm in sending them without the mask anymore. And also, you know, going back in data, you know, if you look at, you know, the amount of the spread that we have here in Florida has been decreasing over the last few months. Mm-hmm. And as compared to other states where there are mask mandates, you know, we've never had some outside of the school. So I fully support
meaning we've never had a mask mandate outside of schools, Chris. Yeah, that's absolutely right here in Florida. Chris in Cooper City. Stuart is in Miami on line two. Stuart, thanks for calling. Love to hear from you.
Hi, thanks for having me. My concern was that the whole reason we put on these paper masks from the outset as opposed to N95s was because the N95s were supposed to be reserved for first responders. The paper masks, the primary thing that they did was keep us from spreading our own germs. So I don't see how this whole mandate thing came down to this personal choice. The personal choice is being made for everybody else. It's backwards. And this is why this thing has been so chaotic, because the medical people have done a poor job of expressing that.
Stuart, I appreciate that. Yeah, it gets right to that point, Dr. Gallen, that I wear a mask to protect you. You wear a mask to protect me. That's the public health mantra that's been stated here when it comes to mask wearing. So how does that begin to play out now that masks are optional? Students in Miami-Dade County can have their parents sign a form and no longer be required to wear a mask in school.
Yes, as we indicated, I mentioned that this decision was not driven by politics. It was not actually driven by educators or even the school board to a greater extent. We relied on the recommendations of our medical experts, that our medical experts were consistent in, is that there is not one size that fits all that will serve as a panacea for many of the challenges that we faced with COVID. But we have to employ several mitigating strategies. Mask is a mitigating strategy. Social distancing is a mitigating strategy. Vaccination is a mitigating strategy. Hand washing is a mitigating strategy. So all of these things combined have led to the significant decrease in positivity rates, hospitalizations, and all of those indicators that we identified at the front end that would drive our decision. So I don't think it's just something. We had a lot of conversation around masks, but I think it was a combination of a lot of strategies that took place that were embraced by the community and has brought the rates down in Miami-Dade County and quite frankly throughout the state of Florida so that we can thereby justify through science and data the lifting of the mask mandate as we know it. While at the same time, as a parent, myself as a parent of an 8-year-old child in the Miami-Dade County Public Schools, giving parents the option to make that determination, of which my daughter will continue to utilize that as a mitigating strategy.
Yeah. And what about the official guidance from the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Gallin? How did that weigh into the considerations of the deliberations? And that guidance from the CDC remains to be masks should be worn in indoor places of with people 2 years old and older.
We still contemplate and consider the recommendations of the CDC, but one of the caveats of those recommendations is that it's predicated on local conditions. As Dr. Cartwright indicated, we look at our local conditions in Miami-Dade, they're looking at their local conditions in Broward, Palm Beach, and et cetera. So the local conditions pursuant to the CDC recommendations are a part of that equation. You can't divorce the two. You can't say CDC recommendations alone without considering local conditions. And the local conditions in Miami-Dade County Public Schools have contemplated the recommendations. And so it's not an either or, it's a both and.
A both and. Dr. Steve Gallin is the vice chair of the Miami-Dade County Public Schools. He is along with us, as well as Dr. Vicki Cartwright, the interim superintendent of Broward County Public Schools. Both public school districts eased back on their mask requirements this week. 800-743-WLRN, parents, teachers, grandparents, aunts, uncles, students, we'd love to hear from you. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Dr. Cartwright, you had argued in a letter that you sent to the Florida Education Commissioner, Richard Corcoran, that you couldn't allow masks to be optional because that would violate rights of thousands of students with disabilities that go to school in Broward County. How has that changed with the optional mask rule that's in place now in Broward?
So one of the things I think it goes back again is when that letter was crafted, the positivity rate here was definitely significantly higher. We had significant amounts of students that were having to quarantine, as well as staff members that were having to quarantine due to either being COVID positive or close contacts. So the conditions were definitely different than where we are right now. You know, the chances of a student becoming a close contact or possibly getting COVID itself was definitely higher at that point. In addition to that, our students at that point, again, didn't have access to being able to become vaccinated as well. So those are the things that I'm talking about that makes the situation today different than what it was back in September.
Now 5 to 11 year olds still haven't had enough time to be fully vaccinated.
That is correct. However, we do know that with just one dose, it does significantly give them some coverage.
So do you feel comfortable now that you have found this balance between following the Florida Parents' Bill of Rights, which is what the Florida governor and the education commissioner have pointed to, that Broward County schools and Dade County schools and others with mandatory mask rules in place were violating, and the legal requirement for schools to have a safe environment for students, including students with disabilities?
I still think it's a slippery slope that we're talking about when we're talking about the parent's choice bill that's out there, because what then happens for other things? For examples, what happens if a parent chooses, oh, I have the right not to put my child into a car seat or buckle them up and when they're riding in a car? That's my choice. It's my child. I get to make that determination. Yeah. I think it's very problematic because as we go forward with this, hopefully we don't get back to a place where we were related to COVID. But what happens in the future if we do? So while the conditions currently allow us to be in compliance with what is currently out there and what is being required by the state, I still say we need to take caution on this. And I would say extreme caution on this, because we don't know what's coming in the future just yet.
I want to ask Dr. Gallin about the future and kind of the guidance and some of the metrics that Miami-Dade County Public Schools will be using. But let me ask you, first of all, each of you have been a party to a lawsuit against the state. An administrative court judge last week ruled in favor of the state that the state did, in fact, have the ability to prohibit your respective school district mask mandates. Dr. Gallin, do you support continuing to appeal that decision, continuing to pursue this in court?
I do. I think there needs to be some additional clarity regarding the issue of local control and being able to make decisions at the local level based on local conditions, whether it's COVID-19 at this particular point or whether it's another issue that may resurrect in the future. I think that question needs to be appropriately disposed of, and I understand that it was ruled upon in the administrative law judge's area, but I think it needs to be explored at a higher level and really kind of put that issue to rest, because I think this is an issue of COVID today, but it could be another issue of local control tomorrow. And I think we really need to make some distinction between what we're able to do as constitutional officers here as elected officials.
Dr. Cartwright, do you support Broward County continuing to be a party to that lawsuit?
Absolutely. I agree with everything that was just stated. And that's what I was talking about before is, you know, conditions can change here at the local level, and we've got to be responsive to our community's needs. I just think it's a slippery slope with us not pursuing it.
Let's pursue a call from Pembroke Pines. Viviana is on line two. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I would like to know, I heard the people in the program mentioning that they're guiding themselves by the scientific data and the medical professionals, but I wonder what kind of data is that and which medical professionals, because I know that here in Florida, there has been discrepancies between what the CDC and the doctors and the nurses and first responders that have been taking care of, you know, people sick by coronavirus, and the people in higher positions that, you know, have been chosen by you know, the governor. So what kind of data? Are we talking about the same data and the same medical professionals?
Got the question, Viviana. Good question. Dr. Gallin, I'll put that to you first in terms of the scientific data that Miami-Dade County Public Schools cited for easing back on the mask mandate and allowing students and parents to opt out. What was the source of the data and the information that you used?
The primary source of data would be the positivity rates over a period of time. We've seen since the onset of COVID that the positivity rates would go up and down. One week they're up, one week they're down. We looked at it over an extended period of time to see whether or not it was trending in the right direction. And that's number one, positivity rates. The second data would be vaccination rates. Obviously, the national goal was around 80%. We're doing tremendously well here in Miami-Dade County in terms of those who are eligible to be vaccinated, being vaccinated. The third iteration that we saw that was horrific throughout this nation was hospitalization availability. We saw throughout the country hospitals that were unable to even house and treat and take care of sick individuals who were from COVID. So those are three salient points of data that we utilized: positivity rates, vaccination rates, hospitalization availability in our district. And thirdly, lastly, she asked the question as relates to the medical experts. We had officials who were experts in their particular field, some nationally renowned experts in terms of medicine and science and disease and vaccinations that represented this community, represented this board, and quite frankly, represent this issue at a national level. and we're very, very proud of the service that they brought forward to this particular issue.
The
CDC does make recommendations, obviously, but again, one caveat is those recommendations are often predicated on the local conditions, right. That data is local data.
Did the Miami-Dade County Public School Board COVID-19 Task Force weigh in on this decision prior to the public announcement?
Absolutely, absolutely. They have been with us every step of the way. This was not a unilateral decision. That's why I indicated that it was not driven by politicians. Mm-hmm. It was not driven by educators. It was driven primarily by the recommendations and the input and the involvement of our medical task force, who has been with us every step of the way throughout this particular challenging journey. So yes, they weighed in significantly and they were in full support of this decision. Because again, the criteria was predetermined.
Right.
This was not making it up as we go. This criteria was predetermined at the onset.
Another caller from Broward County, Frank in Miramar. Frank, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Frank, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Oops, I'm sorry.
That's yes. Okay.
I was just wondering about the date, or at least for Broward, of November 20th. It's just before the major holiday, just before Thanksgiving, just before Christmas, of course. And was any thought given to allowing vaccination rates to pick up? The vaccine just came out a little over a week ago, and allow time for the holidays to go by. We've seen spikes after major holidays in the past. And was that a consideration in coming to November 20th as a date?
Frank, good question. Regarding the vaccine, that's the vaccine eligibility for children 5 to 11 years old. That was recently expanded. That's what Frank's referring to there. Dr. Cartwright, what about the consideration of the upcoming holiday season?
Certainly. So the date, how that was derived, is actually the day after the students are released in order to go for their Thanksgiving break. So that's how we came up with the date of the 20th, which is a Saturday. Related to the concern, what if the rates go back up? Mm-hmm. There is provision still to where if the positivity rates go back up to 5% or higher, for us to take this back to our school board again to follow up with those conversations. So we've put provisions in there and considerations in there in the event that we were to spike again.
Yeah. So just to be clear on that point, Dr. Cartwright, an infection rate of 5% would bring the issue back for discussion, not necessarily automatically trigger the mandate back in place.
You are absolutely correct. Because again, we very similar to Miami-Dade, we take a look at multiple data points in making any recommendation to our board, and then for our board to take into consideration as well. So it's that positivity rate. It's also, was it looking like as far as our quarantine rate within the schools themselves? So again, it's taking a look at all of those different pieces of information. What is the vaccination rate? How are we looking across the entire district? Yeah. And we're looking over a period of time.
Dr. Vicki Cartwright is the interim superintendent of Broward County Public Schools. Superintendent Cartwright, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk with you.
Always. And Dr. Steve Gallen, vice chair of the Miami-Dade County Public School Board and the school board member representing District 1. Dr. Gallen, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for your input as well.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, and everyone be safe. Thank you, and have a great weekend.
Indeed. We've got more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. We're going to talk about the pay gap between men and women in South Florida. It has been getting wider. 800-743-9576. Your phone calls on the pay gap next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public broadcasting. I'm Tom Hudson. 19 cents per dollar. That was the difference between what men earned in 2019 in Miami-Dade County and what women earned. Women earn 19 cents less per dollar than men. That pay gap has grown from just a few years earlier, according to data released this week by the Women's Fund. And this was before the pandemic and COVID-19 and all the devastating economic impacts that it brought, especially for women who proportionally lost more jobs, lost more pay, and have not returned to the workforce at the same rate as men. So why has this gender pay gap grown in South Florida? employees, workers, we want to hear from you. Do you have personal experience that you can share about this pay gap? How does the pay gap impact your household spending, your household budget, your prosperity? And business owners, phones are open for you as well. How do you think about this pay difference between men and women? Do you pay attention to it on your own payroll every few weeks, every month, or however often you cut paychecks? And why is this important for the entire South Florida economy? Now, here's the phone number, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us your thoughts on Twitter. We're at WLRN. Maria Mayer is with us, the interim executive director of the Women's Fund, the group behind the data that was released this week. Welcome to WLRN. Nice to have you.
So grateful for the opportunity to engage with you all in our community on this issue. It's very important. Thank you so much.
Incredibly important issue. So what has contributed to this widening pay gap that you found between, what was it, 2016 and 2019?
There are things that we know, and there are many things we don't know. Thus underlies the reason that we do need the data, and we do need it as quickly as possible. I think one of the great things I'd like to focus on, Tom, is that today, in this time that we have with you, we can look at this as an opportunity to get behind and dig down to why those things are happening and make a difference. And it will make a difference to the South Florida economy, as you mentioned before. We do know some things. When there's smoke, there's fire. There are many people who are not able to go back to work at this time because they don't have the support systems to be able to get back to work. The Women's Fund, you may know, has been engaged in grant making throughout our 30-year history, working with all kinds of different organizations like Lotus House and FOM and Casa Valentina with small grants. Now we're focusing on going to look at how women are not able to return to work because of the lack of childcare, for example.
So prior to the pandemic, which is what this data captures, what contributed to the widening gap? Because when you look at the dashboard that the Women's Fund has published here, the gap had been narrowing for several years. It wasn't solved by any stretch, but it was down to 15 cents on the dollar in 2017 before widening again before COVID-19.
I'm going to ask Dr. Maria Chabal, who's on our board and is on here with us, to help address that. Once again, there are things that we know and other things that we don't know. But Maria, I'll let you take this question.
Yeah, let me introduce Maria officially. Maria, thank you for that. Maria Alcheva is the assistant research professor and assistant director of planning and operations at FIU's Perez Metropolitan Center. Maria, professor, nice to speak with you again. Thanks again for your time. So what has contributed to that widening effect that we saw before the pandemic, especially after years of slowly but beginning to narrow that pay gap?
Good afternoon, Tom. Thank you for having us. As always, you don't cover these issues, and that's certainly an issue that deserves. But I can't answer your question in a straightforward way, the way people would want to hear it, because the answer is complex. I also want to note that pay gap, so that it's when people compare the trends or look at that number, are aware that we're looking at full-time employees. So we're just focusing on full-time women versus full-time men. That's where the gap is 19%, as you noted, it expanded.
Yeah.
And that is very surprising given what we know about the pre-pandemic year, right? The economy was booming, unemployment was at its lowest rate, wages were finally rising above inflation to pre-Great Recession levels and above. And then yet we see that rising disparity. And here is one maybe very controversial, but very rational, reasonable answer. We know that women are still not the primary breadwinner in many families. And it is women who usually sacrifice their career growth and economic mobility when the hard choices need to be made. Mm-hmm. Here is what I'm talking about, and I'm connecting it to what we've been hearing during the pandemic. More women are staying out of the labor force, because they're the ones who take care of the family, they're the ones who take care of children, and again, they're typically the lower income earner, so they make the choice to either stay out of the workforce, take a more lower paid and more flexible job that allows them to still fulfill these family duties, and if possible, work fewer hours, even if it's a full-time job. So the reason why the pay gap was decreasing back before the pre-pandemic in the pre-pandemic years is because in a booming economy, it's usually women who fall behind for these reasons.
Mm-hmm. And as the expansion matures, it begins to stretch out into further corners of the labor force employee market. Talking about the pay gap here in South Florida between men and women, some new data that came from FIU's Perez Metropolitan Center and the Women's Fund finding that the pay gap before the pandemic was expanding again in Miami-Dade County. 800-743-WLRN. Share your experiences, employees, workers. We'd love to hear stories about the pay gap, how you think about this in your paycheck. Business owners, when it comes to payroll, what are your considerations regarding pay differences between men and women? 800-743-WLRN. Tony is in Deerfield Beach. Tony, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hey, thank you very much. Essentially, I have a question and a comment. First comment is I have two girls who work. One's in her own business, so everything's dependent on her as she goes to build her business. The second one, she worked in, and generally, she was in the same position, and she was making salary and commissions. And I think that she was a little underpaid, but it was more from you know, first coming into a position, even with several years of experience. However, you know, in working with her, I told her, just assert yourself on what you need and where you need to go. And if it doesn't work for you, then find a different position. And she actually was interviewing now for a different position by a company that recognizes her talent and capabilities. So that was just one comment I wanted to make.
Yeah.
The second one is, when you look at the gender pay gap differences, are there any specifics in the study when you're looking at similar positions and things like that, or is it more generalized differences on full-time workers?
Good question about the data there, Tony. We'll put that to Maria Alcheva with FIU.
I agree. Great, great question. And I want to emphasize that this is just the first tool, the first phase of our dashboard. We wanted to lay the foundation. But if you look at some of the reports that I've worked on for Broward County, I heard you mention you're in Deerfield Beach, so you might be interested in looking at that data from the Status of Women report for Broward County. The idea is for us to expand the dashboard and to use more data points to answer that question. What I can tell you is based on my experience over the last few years is that women are getting paid less across most high wage occupations. And what I'm talking about is, for example, the legal occupation, we're talking about architecture and engineering, we're talking about managerial positions. So we're not looking just at the disparity overall for full-time employees, as I noted, but eventually our dashboard for Miami-Dade will include these comparisons across industry sectors and across occupations.
800-743-9576 to join our conversation about the pay gap here in South Florida, your experiences with it, workers, employees, family members. You talk about it across the kitchen table about paychecks. 800-743-9576. Maria Mayer with the Women's Fund. Why is it important to capture this data, this information? We can see it at the national level. To some degree, we can see it at the state level. But as we look closer at smaller regions, sometimes it can be a little bit more noisy to get this kind of information. So why is it important to capture this?
It certainly is. Data is a lens that helps us see everything more clearly. And if you don't look, if you don't see, you miss a lot. So that happens across all areas. When you look at data like the fact that an average woman does 2.5 times more uncompensated work than a man does, you stop, you pause, you listen, and that conversation across the dinner table, Tom, changes, correct? Mm-hmm. It also changes, I admire the comment of the first caller, and referring to his daughter. It is important to say those things out loud, to ask and not be afraid to stand up and ask what other people are earning who are doing comparable work in your company. Those kind of conversations have not been encouraged before. They've been seen as brashy or impolite. And actually, it's about equity and fairness. And so having these conversations and normalizing these conversations is absolutely essential. That's what will close that data gap.
Money is the last taboo, isn't it? Money is the last taboo. Yeah. What about the impact, Maria, on health and health outcomes when it comes to pay and South Florida?
That's a really interesting one. When you look at the coverage that we have for in our health and well-being pillar, you're looking at the average coverage that people have for health insurance. So it seems really basic. So it's like everybody should be able to get health insurance. In the current system that we have, more women are not getting full-time employment, and they're not getting that full, more luxurious coverage through their employers. So if you're part-time because you're responsible for the other issues in your household, like Maria indicated, you're less likely to have that full coverage, more likely to need public coverage, and that affects everyone's health.
Maria, this pay gap, does it include benefits? Does it include a full compensation package when you look at that 19 cents per dollar gap between men and women in Dade County?
Well, now in the 19%, we're only talking about earnings. So the pay really that that people get for a full-time job. I just want to add, that was a great question. How does the gap affect health? And in the health industry, research has shown that there are various social determinants to health. And one of the primary determinants is linked to economic opportunity, economic mobility. I mean, housing is also connected, poverty levels. All of these contribute to health disparities. So we in the dashboard, we seek to put the transparency, to increase the transparency on all of these issues, but also to connect them, how they intersect with each other, and how without solving pay disparity, we will have a really challenging time, probably impossible to solve all the other issues related to either health or safety of women or leadership.
Maria, you mentioned some of the occupations, the high-earning occupations, architects, lawyers, engineers, for instance. What do we know about the women who are working full-time who are experiencing this 19% pay gap?
Well, what we know, unfortunately, I'll go back to the earlier discussion because it was very on point. Most employers discourage these kinds of talks. If they don't overtly forbid them, prohibit them, they discourage them. And what you mentioned, Tom, money is the last taboo issue. I hope that becomes the case, but that's still not the reality that we live in. Without transparency, without awareness of how we can compare to each other in terms of pay, in terms of experience, tenure, how these things affect our pay, we won't get to the point where women, as your previous caller said, will be able to advocate for themselves and to negotiate for fair positions, for fair pay.
A couple of weeks ago, I happened to grab data from the state of Florida to look at across genders and age groups about who lost jobs during the pandemic in Florida. Not the kinds of jobs, but who are the people, the thousands, tens of thousands of people, even in South Florida, who lost jobs. And the data between 2019 and 2020, this is statewide, found that the employment of women dropped 8% compared to down 6% for men. So we know proportionally that women were hit harder by furloughs, by layoffs, by company closings because of COVID-19. And we also know that it was worse, particularly for Black women, who lost employment by 9%. How do we need to be thinking about that moving forward, Maria?
We don't have that data in our dashboard yet, but right. I want to recognize the Children's Trust supporting our efforts to focus on disparities across racial and ethnic groups. So that's the next phase in the expansion, in the second phase of the dashboard. But I want to also mention in relation to who lost jobs is the jobs that were lost were in lower wage sectors. So I don't want to, I'm not clairvoyant, but what we may see when the 2020 data comes out is, I suspect we might see the decrease of that gap from 19% to less. And why? The reason why is because it was mostly women who lost jobs who were in these low wage, mm-hmm. retail, tourism related jobs. And once you cut the bottom out, obviously the middle and wage earners are going to influence the overall median earnings figure.
Wow.
So it will the data will mask a little bit the challenges for Black and Hispanic women, not just in the state. I think that will be applicable to South Florida as well.
Maria Elcheva is the Assistant Research Professor, Assistant Director of Planning and Operations at Florida International University's Perez Metropolitan Center. A hand on economic data. Maria, thanks for sharing your expertise with us here today.
My pleasure, Tom, always.
Always great to speak with you. Maria Mayer, you stick with us. She is the Interim Executive Director with the Women's Fund. We're going to talk more about the gender pay gap in South Florida and what some potential solutions to addressing the difference, the disparity in pay between men and women here could be. Also, your phone calls at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public broadcasting. We're talking about money. We're talking about paychecks. A gap between pay for men and pay for women, it persists in South Florida, and it's getting wider, at least in the year before the pandemic in Miami-Dade County, according to data released this week by the Women's Fund. Have you experienced a wage gap? Have you addressed a wage gap? What's been the impact on your household budget? And if you own a company, how do you think about employee pay and equal pay? How can this pay gap be addressed and why? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Maria Mayer is with us, the Interim Executive Director at the Women's Fund. And we also say hello now to Carrie Ann Royce, the President and CEO of YWCA South Florida. Carrie Ann, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Is this pay gap acknowledged in the job market by companies, do you think?
I do believe that it is acknowledged. I think it's acknowledged more so today, and that it is a more acceptable conversation that's been having with the rise in conversations around inequities, especially when we talk about the fact that there is a major intersectionality in these pay gaps when it comes on to women of color.
And so what's needed to address the pay gap? Where does a company begin? Where does a community begin?
There are several things that companies can do. And I think one of the first things we have to recognize is that representation always matters, right? The more women, the more people of color, the more diversity that we have at the table, the more conversations of inequities that become normalized, the more we are able to get ahead of these kind of issues. We know that representation matters, and that's why we have to make sure that women are attracted to, being drawn to, and at the table in underrepresented industries in South Florida, many of which are beginning to really take a hard look at themselves as we start to shine a light in some of those dark places. And we also have to work directly with the employers, because most employers, I really do believe, want to do the right thing. I think a lot of employers are scratching their heads as to where to begin in doing the right thing. And as Maria and Maria said earlier, you can't address what you don't quantify. Mm-hmm. You have to start with the data.
Yeah.
Do that deep dive into the demographics of your workforce and provide equal opportunity for advancement. There are several other ways that employers can address it too.
I'll ask you about those in a moment. Let me bring Maria back into the program with the Women's Fund. What has been the response from the for-profit sector regarding this light shining on a pay gap in Miami-Dade County?
We have some real leaders in our community, and I have to say that Kaufman Rawson has been one of them. They've been very active, and they are supporters of the Women's Fund and of the YWCA. They have taken a purposeful look at what they do in their hiring practices, and they make sure that they have consistency, so they have that policy in-house. Norwegian Cruise Lines does the same, and both of those corporations have said that they are very willing to share what they have learned along the way. This isn't about shame, this is about opportunity. There's several different things that are relatively simple. Carrie Ann touched on it. If you do not have a purposeful plan and continue to train that gender lens, you will not see what you're missing. If you do not have people in leadership, you will not have people who are noticing how seniority, for example, can affect one of the data points that you gave before, Tom. Women were let go first. Why? Often it's the person who's come in and out of the workforce who has less seniority, and so they go first. Who's coming in and out of the workforce? The people who are taking that 2.5 times more of their unpaid time to take care of the elderly, children, other issues that have been underestimated and undervalued traditionally in our societies, but that does not have to be the norm moving forward. We can do better if we stop and analyze and look at it.
Let's hear from Barbara in Miami. She's been listening in. Thanks for calling, Barbara. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to bring up divorce, because divorce and working, it's really difficult on moms that are single moms, they're working, and then beginning in a divorce scenario, these things aren't taken into account. The fact that the mother usually is going to bear the burden of the child rearing, the going to doctors and taking care of the kids. And so in a divorce scenario, it's kind of hard to look at equal, yet we know that in many cases, the woman's the one that's going to have to carry the load of that burden and then try to keep a job at the same time. Whereas the ex-husband might be able to continue working as if nothing's happened. So I think we got to look at even those scenarios, starting with how the laws are written when it comes to divorce and how it affects jobs afterwards.
Barbara, I appreciate you bringing that point up. When I looked at the Florida state employment data, looking about, again, ages and races and genders, about who lost jobs in 2020, there's a category that the state captures that's titled Women Who Maintain Families. There is no category that says Men Who Maintain Families. And you know, maybe that's to a broader point there that Barbara is making about the impact of divorce on women and their financial well-being. Mario, what do you think there?
Excellent point. And I'm glad that you noticed that data point, Tom. It's really quite spectacular when you think about that category. 1 out of 5 women in Miami-Dade County do live in poverty, and the majority are single parents. As Dr. Ocheva mentioned before, all of these gears mesh. It affects your economic mobility, affects your ability to lead, your health. They all mesh together. One of the major problems that most women have is that they need to work more than one job because they're underpaid. And then the cost of childcare is exceptionally high. That is something this community needs to fix. And we're not going to do it alone. We do need to focus on that together.
Carrie Ann, I heard you agree there to that one.
Absolutely. Because Maria made a point about 1 in 5 women living in poverty in Miami-Dade County. 88% of single heads of household in Miami-Dade County who are women are living either paycheck to paycheck or in poverty. 88%.
Whoa.
That's staggering.
9 out of 10.
9 out of 10 single heads of household women are living either paycheck to paycheck or in poverty. That is staggering. And therefore, it's imperative upon us as employers to rethink the way that we approach the value of women in the workplace and the lived experience of women in how we're recruiting, in how we're building our compensation, in how we are looking at even the benefits structure. Are we looking at benefits that really apply to making sure childcare is no longer a barrier, to making sure that we're not you know, having meetings that happen after 5 p.m. and then saying that the value of that particular employee is diminished because they can't participate. There are many of those factors that come into play each time, and to make sure that women can fully participate in the economy.
Carrie Ann Roys is the president and chief executive officer at YWCA South Florida. Carrie Ann, thanks for sharing your time and your comments and expertise with us. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Maria Mayer is the interim executive director at the Women's Fund. And Maria, thanks so much for spending so much time with us here today during our conversation.
We appreciate it. Always here for you all. Thank you.
Much appreciated. And thanks to all the callers and those tweeting as well here on the South Florida Roundup. Our program is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's editorial director is Alicia Zuckerman. The director of radio operations and our program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mares. Richard Ives answers the phones. Thanks for calling, listening, supporting public radio. Thanks for tweeting as well. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great and safe weekend. Our program on WLRN here is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.